Welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight is The Compromise Trap with Elizabeth Doty. I will be reading her bio for you in just a minute. We are recording this program tonight, so as I've told you, please be conscious of everything going on. We invite our audience listening at home to tune in to visit our website at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Doty. Elizabeth has spent 30 years working in and around large organizations in three different careers. She began in the hospitality industry, working for 11 years as a manager in several four-star hotels. In 1990, she joined a re-engineering firm working hands-on with leaders and frontline employees in half a dozen different industries trying to transform their businesses for the better. Finally, in 1994, she launched her own consulting firm and has since consulted to organizations as diverse as Intuit, Hewlett-Packard, Stanford University, and Archstone Smith. Based on these varied experiences, Elizabeth is intimately familiar with the inspirations, dilemmas, and absurdities of organizational life. A chronic interviewer, she's spoken with over 400 people about their day-to-day work lives and the challenges and triumphs of doing work they are truly proud of. These stories form the core of her book, The Compromise Trap, How to Thrive at Work Without Selling Your Soul, which was rated in the 7 Best Career Management Books of 2010, and which we will have for sale after the program out in the lobby. Elizabeth's current mission focuses on encouraging professionals to step up more proactively to improve the effectiveness and integrity of the organizations where they work, for their personal sanity and well-being, to improve organizational results, and to fulfill their organization's responsibilities to the larger world. Elizabeth has presented at the Business Ethics Network, the Organizational Development Network, the Harvard Business School Association of Boston, and the Society of Organizational Learning. Elizabeth earned her bachelor's degree in economics from UC Berkeley in 1985 and her MBA from Harvard in 1991. When Elizabeth's people approached me about this program and sent me her book, I got to read it. I was very interested to find a very conscious approach to business. Part of what we're trying to do in the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club is really focus on a much higher level of awareness and a much higher level of personal joy, really, at work. And so that work isn't work, as we say in the old sense, but work is joyful and work is right livelihood. And I know there are some Buddhists here tonight. So with that, I'd like to introduce Elizabeth Doty.
Great. Thank you all. Thank you very much, and thank you, Kevin, for the lovely introduction, including your personal reasons for having me tonight. Is the audio a little loud? Is it okay? You can hear me okay? And it was interesting to me to be at the Commonwealth Club because I have many incredibly positive memories of coming to the club in my early career. Kevin mentioned I worked in the hotel business. It was two blocks from here, and so I would come to the club events, and it's an incredible forum for talking about current events with just a small group like this, talking with people who are really in the midst of making some pretty important decisions. So I just renewed my membership after 20 years, and I encourage you all to consider that as well. And I appreciate all of you taking the time to be here this evening. I'd like to talk with you about compromise, courage, and a new mindset for work that has the chance, I think, to make the idea of integrity at work, greater consciousness at work, go viral. An approach that could help us help each other live up to that sense of work as joy, work as what it could be. And I know many of us are very disturbed by the barrage in the headlines. It's almost this amazing contrast between the number of people trying to do socially responsible business, values-based business, and the headlines saying what we're actually doing. And not just in industry after industry. We can't isolate it to Wall Street. It's in many industries. But it's also in society as a whole. The statistics coming out are relatively shocking. One study I just read said that 64% of high school students had cheated at least once in the prior year. 18% of adults 25 to 40 feel that it's necessary to lie or cheat at least occasionally to succeed. And 90% of the people surveyed felt their ethics were fine. Only 30% of the people surveyed in a Gallup poll trust the businesses they do business with regularly. And that's just in delivering on what they say they're going to do, not having socially responsible missions and all this other stuff. And in my interviews and research for the Compromise Trap, I found 60% of the people felt they had to alter or censor their professional judgment about what would make the business succeed in order to please their boss or deal with politics. So these kinds of things are very disturbing, and yet if we dig a little deeper into it, I think there is enormous opportunity that it actually takes a very subtle shift for us to live up to our values. And the major factor is the people around us and the institutions that we're in. So in a way, we're a part of each other living with integrity, part of each other living up to our potential. And that's the argument I hope to make through this evening. I consider this idea of compromise and courage at work to be very important, partly because of the costs, which I'll go into it for a moment, but I also consider if we challenge the myth that you have to go along and compromise in some of the ways that we're pressed to, then we might get on with the idea of work as joy. We might get on with what work could really create in the world, the value, the potential for work to be, for businesses and hybrid businesses to be part of transforming society. But at a minimum, it's an important issue because of the costs. When we get it wrong with compromising at work, and I'll define compromise a little more specifically in a moment, there are tremendous costs I see on three levels. One is the individual costs. When we feel like we have to compromise our principles and values at work, people describe to me in countless interviews, I've spoken with over 110 people on the book subject, in particular, out of the 400 overall, people described it as deadening, as soul-destroying, when they had to do work that compromised who they were and what they cared about. It's deeply anxiety-producing to do this. One woman I spoke to said that she didn't recognize her own face in the mirror after 20 years working her way up to a vice president of a petrochemical company. Literally, her jaw was hard and her eyes were cold. She didn't recognize herself because of who she had become from work. People report losing motivation, creativity, self-respect. So there are individual costs if we can't live up to our values and principles at work. Then there are the business costs. And this is not always obvious because we say the reason people compromise is for greed, to make profit. But my work has been in studying recurring dysfunctions in organizations. And most of the time, it's bad for the organization, too. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the book Good to Great. This is one of the best-selling business books of all time. Well, the author did another book that didn't do so well because we don't like talking about negative stuff. And it was called How the Mighty Fall. And he studied 11 companies that had been great and fell into obscurity or died, while others in their industries thrived. And the difference was they didn't have the discipline to live up to their promises, keep their standards, or stay focused on what was really core for their business. They got too short-term focused. So it actually killed the business when they made the wrong compromises. And then lastly, and probably the most emotional, and there is some stuff tonight, we got to land this. This makes a difference in real lives. And people have been encouraging me to actually come out and be a little clearer about this. When we compromise at work, sometimes people die. I have Deepwater Horizon up here and the Tokyo Electric Power Company. On the Deepwater Horizon rig, the thing that's most stuck with me was that the installation manager, there's a quote now, have you heard this, of a phone call that he made on the morning of the fire? This has kind of been in some of the headlines, where he said, "Are you happy now? The rig's on fire. I told you this was going to happen." So this is an employee who was, and they don't know who he was speaking to. That's going to be the crux of the lawsuit. Was it his boss? Was it BP? He worked for Transocean. But employees speaking up about the real risks in situations can lead to, in this case, 11 people dying. Peanut Corporation of America, the salmonella in the peanut butter, led to 9 people dying, the risk of kids dying. I mean, it's not just big industry. Lots of our work has impact on people's lives. So it matters if we actually live up to the principles and standards and the responsibilities that we have in whatever our field. I've been really fortunate. I think one of the ways I've stayed sane in all the consulting work I've done is I've talked to everyone I can in train stations, in airports, whatever, to hear their story of how they make meaning out of their work. How do you find something important in your work? And out of that, I have heard a lot of people sorting out compromises, sorting out what they can do and what they can't do and what feels right and what feels wrong. And tonight I'm going to share some of those stories. I do have to disguise some of the industries, some of the names, out of an agreement or respect for the people involved, because there are some things that were harmful and they don't feel comfortable about. Tonight, one person was particularly on my mind as an example of sorting out the compromises we should make and the ones we shouldn't. This was Julie. And I met with her just up the street. Do any of you know the restaurant, the Metropole? It's up on Sutter. It's a great little French bistro. So we met there. I had my little digital tape recorder and we were listening. And I asked her, as my interviews required, tell me your work journey. Tell me the story of your work journey and what guided you when you made your most important decisions. And she started when she was 32. That's where she wanted to start her story. She was recently divorced, single mother of two, no college degree, and no place to live. She was sleeping on people's couches, moving around. So she told herself to get a backbone. And she said, I decided, I could see she got really emphatic when she said this. She said, I decided that I'm going to prove to myself, to my kids, and the world that I could be a winner. And I was going to do whatever it took to be that winner. And when she made that decision, she became Superwoman. She said, I drove myself like a machine. I looked the part, I dressed the part, I acted the part. I learned how to talk, how to pretend like I didn't have kids, how to stroke the boss's ego. She gave me the best metaphor I've heard yet about how to respond to change at work. She said, you don't just agree with a new initiative, right? There's something new comes along, it's the hottest thing in a company. So you don't just agree with it, you put the frosting on it. She said, how can I? That's fantastic. How can I help? Any of you ever had to do that? Or felt like you had to do that? She really gung-ho got on board, right? And it worked. So she made these, so if I can get it to go here, she made these decisions, drove herself to do this. It was kind of a sacrifice. It was a bit of a way of thinking about it as a healthy compromise because it felt necessary. And she moved up. She moved up. She chose the accounting field. She moved up to become a senior director. Oh, welcome. To be a senior director of a Fortune 50 company, and then she became the chief financial officer of a Fortune 500 company and chief operating officer at the same time. But to do that, this drive to go along, this drive to do whatever it took, led to some things that didn't sit well with her, things that tore her apart inside. It was a different impression. You had the surface impression and then inside. And this was echoed in many of my interviews. One of them was that they used layoffs to achieve financial targets to get bonuses in the current quarter. And she said, you get the bonus and the truth gets buried. And I'm not talking about layoffs that she felt were necessary for the business to be strong for the future. It was for the short-term financial bonuses of the executives involved. And it was short-shrifting the business's capacity for the future. And then she went even further. She said, I turned a blind eye when they laid off entire departments to avoid firing people they didn't like, to avoid discrimination charges. She said, this goes against everything I believe in. It tore me up inside. Literally, it's a very interesting metaphor. It tore her up like it split one part of herself and the other part of herself, right? And she said, but I stuffed it. I had to go on. The only place it showed up was at home with my kids. Does that sound familiar? The stress of doing this, of being someone that wasn't true to her, showed up in her home life. But she kept going. She felt she had to. She said that in the end, in a fear-based culture, it felt like I had to kill or be killed. And so as she did that, she was getting promotions, vacations, the nice home, the nice car. And then one day, at this peak of her career, her kids sat her down, now 19 and 20 years old. They said, Mom, come in here. We want to talk to you. We want to tell you, truthfully, we don't like you very much as a person. You might tell us you're doing this for us, but stop. Don't put it on us. We don't want this. This isn't the life we want. We don't care about those vacations and that car. We don't want to be around you as a person. She was devastated. I had been doing it for them. I thought I had to. I thought this was what life was supposed to look like. Right? And she said, but when I look back, going from, and you're going to laugh at the numbers when we think about Wall Street CEO compensation, but still, this was her reality, and for most of us, this was a big increase. Going from $150,000 a year to $250,000 a year to $350,000 a year was just a number. But I lost myself in the process. This is that dynamic of unhealthy compromise where you go from compromising to being compromised. And she said, I lost myself in the process and I did irreparable harm to my relationship with my daughter. Her son was able to get back in connection with her, but her relationship with her daughter was done for a long, long time. So there was this internal split for her with intense personal costs. And I'd like to be able to say that this was just Julie. It was just one person who made a bad mistake and don't do that one. But unfortunately, there was a pattern here that different people got into for different periods of time until they woke up and got out of it. And the pattern began usually with this sense that an internal drive to succeed, to prove you test your competence, prove what you were worth, see what you could accomplish, that meant you had to play along with the game. It was kind of this, I'm signing up, right? And that wasn't a bad thing. It was just, I'm committed. I'm going to do this, right? And as people got into it, they started describing things that, to me, are a little troubling, might be a little troubling to you, but they don't have to be on the surface. In a lot of organizations, you may have heard these phrases. But people used metaphors like, I had to drink the Kool-Aid. Do you all remember where that came from? Anybody not remember? I've been in some groups where people don't remember with it. Jim Jones, right? Drink the Kool-Aid. You're really committed. You're going to die with everybody. Right? You're going to go down on the Titanic. Don't need the lifeboats. The other one they used I thought was kind of interesting. Any Trekkies here? Anybody admit to being a Trekkie? I literally adopt the voice and they'd say, you will be assimilated. Resistance is futile. Right? So this idea of signing up, Julie used the phrase, I learned to play the part, kind of acting, right? And go along with it. But what people were surprised by was that often led to unhealthy pressure. That there was pressure in the system, even people they admired, even leaders they loved, they still came up against pressure to do things that didn't feel right. Do things that were shortcuts. One CFO, and I, you know, my business school classmates now, they're at a stage where they're kind of seeing the chinks in the armor and saying things like, I didn't realize I'd have to fight my own side. Right? Right? One example that was kind of the poster child for this one was a company that's a values-based business, highly conscious, just an icon of a company that's really committed to health. They made healthy food. And the woman who worked in customer service there said they were so conscious and inclusive and aware of their processes with everything except the manufacturing floor, where they had a half-time manager and everybody spoke Spanish. And so that wasn't included in their processes for having this healthy, conscious culture, right? So at one point, she started getting things mailed back to her in envelopes that had fallen into the product. People were getting sick. And this is a company that was so, I mean, you love them for how mission-oriented. I can't tell you who they are. But you just don't want a company like that to do it. So people were surprised that there were chinks in the armor even in fantastic companies. People described to me feeling kind of the wounds of commitment because they loved the leaders that they worked for and they still felt themselves being pressed to do this. And then once they fell into the compromise, and like Julie, they didn't really realize it at the time. It wasn't like, oh, okay, now I'm going to sign a devil's bargain and here it is. Right? It was kind of like you're moving fast and we got to get the targets and, oh my God, look what we just did. But once they did it, and often it's because people didn't feel strong enough, didn't feel enough self-confidence to push back, that after they had made that unhealthy compromise, they felt even greater pressure to play along with the game because they felt less confident, less strong, less able to push back. And there are all kinds of psychological reasons for this. There's an escalating commitment to getting the goal. Once you've compromised, you've really got to prove that the promotion was going to make it worthwhile. You get more susceptible to bullies once you've gone along with unhealthy compromise. I've identified 7 different things that happen when you compromise your values that make it more likely that you'll do another one. Right? So not fun. This is the point at which people usually Give me the good news, please. Right? So the interesting thing is that you feel in that moment that you can't do anything else until something wakes you up. And for Julie, it got to the point with her kids that something woke her up and challenged her to take a different approach. And this is what I'm going to raise as what I call a new leadership mindset that I call redefining the game. And for Julie, this is where you start questioning, do I really need what I thought I needed to prove I was successful? Do I need it to come from outside? Do I need to have that vacation, the home, the car, whatever it was I set my targets on? And you start asking your own criteria, your own currency for what you measure as success. Right? And in this case, Julie went into a period of intense soul searching. Oh my God, my kids don't like me. This was all for them. Right? How many people make compromises because of kids? Compromise at work. What would you say? It's a pretty good number, right? Most of what I hear is a mortgage and kids. It's the reason people feel like they have to play along with the game. But she went into this soul searching and said, you know what? I started wondering why I thought so much about what other people think of me. I started realizing it came from a sense of personal deficit and that I was looking for this approval from outside. So it was a psychological need more than actually needing a bigger house or a better car or more vacations. Once she recognized that, she reclaimed her own sense of authority. And the next job she took as another executive in another company, she took them through hard times, but she said she did it the way she thought was right, that came from her sense of natural authority. And she made a decision that for her, being a professional meant also being a good person. There were a number of people, I think it was a huge pattern in the interviews that I listened to and that I spoke to people about, that they made this shift to realizing they had more freedom than they thought. They weren't as stuck as they thought. And that they could make this choice. And then once they did, they actually ended up reinforcing their courage. And that's one of those things about courage, right? When you take a risk, you actually do something, you kind of, oh, I can do this. Especially as you do more of it, then you get skills for it. And some of the things we assume that are not possible, people actually completely blow your pictures about that. I'll give you one example of somebody that I saw redefining the game that was, I have deep respect for this fellow. He was a junior loan officer in a global conglomerate that had a financial services arm, making loans on apartment buildings. And he had a loan for an apartment building in a neighborhood that was never going to be able to pay back the loan, right? In the recent economy, he would have taken that loan, right? And tried to sell it off and would have gone from there. But he said no. He said, I'm not going to do this loan. Well, it turns out the father of the person applying for the loan was really high up in government and was friends with the chairman of the company. So he got a memo handed down, this was long enough ago that it was a paper memo, with red ink all over it. Who the hell is holding up this loan? Let's get on this right away. Why are we stalling on this? Five levels of executive down to him. Make this loan. What would we have done?
We're going to lose money, we're going to lose it, so as long as you're willing to eat the $200 million, whatever it's going to be, then we can do it.
Lay out the trade-off for him. And that's one good way to do it. The play the game approach would even be a little more soft pedal than that, and
that's
say,
not the play the game approach.
No, that's more the redefine. There are many of us who would say, I'm a junior loan officer, I'm in my first year, I'll just do the loan. But he redefined the game. And what he did was he laid out the trade-off, but he did it slightly differently. He said, I'm not going to make a bad loan. I made a commitment when I signed this company to help the company. This is not in the company's interests. But I would love for you to show me where I'm wrong in my analysis. And they went through four committee reviews, and every one said, you know what, it's a bad loan. And it ended up floating back up to the chairman of the company. And he said, fine, got it. Can't make the loan. Went back to his crony, said, you know what, we shouldn't have taken that loan. Right? So here's someone way down in an organization that was able to influence all the way up, and I think that probably rippled through multiple other decisions because he was able to do that. When we ask ourselves what makes the difference between playing the game and being able to see the chance to redefine the game, when people see that they have the freedom to do that, it's usually because there's some assumptions we haven't questioned, some assumptions we haven't challenged. This is what came to me when I listened to Julie. At the end of our conversation, she said, you know, all this heartache of me losing my relationship with my daughter and losing myself, came from the fact that I had two unexamined assumptions and what I'm going to now call misconceptions. They were, you can't set limits at work, and this is what my kids want. And I realized these were really important because these were what kept her thinking she had to play the game and kiss up and do what she was told, right? And cross all those lines. And if we find these, then we can re-examine whether we want to play the game or shift over to redefining the game. So I went back through all my interviews, and I started trying to find the particular assumptions that other people had made that led them to play the game or to feel like it was too costly not to. And so the bulk of the book is examining, the bulk of the compromise trap is examining these 10 misconceptions and are they really true. The first set tend to be when we start out working for a company or in our careers that we've got to get to the top. That's when I'm going to be happy, right? I got to prove I'm a winner, whatever degree it is. Some of us more, some of us less. The next one is, I say compromise is always healthy. The way this really shows up is I got to sacrifice. I got to be flexible if I'm going to get to the next, to the top. And if I work for a good company, I won't face this pressure, so I'm fine. Right? You get a little further into your career, and you start to get into some unhealthy compromises, some pressures, starting to see the costs. And that's when you get into the misconceptions that have to do with, oh, I can outsource my integrity to my leader. Right? If I compromise, it's their fault. Well, this doesn't work too well. The engineers on the Ford Explorer, you remember the one that rolled over and caused terrible paralysis, really tragic things? It was the engineers that felt bad. They reported it to management, but it was on their conscience. You can't, if you're doing something wrong, just because your leader tells you, it doesn't relieve your conscience in practice. The idea that you have to go along... Yeah, they did. And then the management didn't respond. The management didn't connect the dots. They did some interesting things. They held accounting reviews, but not safety reviews, and so they didn't turn on that part of their brains. But in the end, it was the engineers sitting in the courtroom who felt the most guilt, took it on personally. I mean, the question is, what were the managers thinking, and why didn't they show up as well? But the engineers were not able to relieve themselves of that feeling just because they had told management about it. They felt they needed to escalate it more. Yeah. The next would be, you can't set limits, you have to go along at work. I'm not going to go into these in great detail. That's the bulk of the book, and it's too long for our short time here. But this second set basically have to do with, what can I do when I'm facing pressure that I can see is unhealthy? And then the third set is, if I'm going to push back, what does that look like? And this is useful both for minimizing the career suicide effect, if you're going to push back, and secondly, for not psyching ourselves out, right? If we think we're going to have career suicide if we push back, then we won't push back. So really testing what does it look like, building the skills to push back. Like the guy with the no bad loan, he did that very skillfully. He said, here's my process, tell me what I did wrong. That's one of the best practices for this. I was fortunate to work with Dr. William Urey on his book, The Power of a Positive No, and there's a recipe for saying no effectively that doesn't trigger retaliation. We got to learn that. And then the last one I think is very interesting. We have some assumptions that if everyone in a company has ethics, the company will have ethics. And this is the area I'm most intrigued by now, because that's not true. If we don't transfer promises, there are all kinds of things that have to happen for the company to live up to its promises beyond just individuals. And if we don't know that, we either get too discouraged or assume we're doing enough when we're not. Right? I went over these very briefly, but there's one in particular that I want to dive into that's the most surprising to people, aside from the good companies have pressure to compromise. So you game to keep going a little bit further into the kind of the discouraging data before we turn around. So this one I find very interesting. In fact, I spoke to a judge, a very respected judge, who works at my gym, and we were on the treadmills together, and he said, no, people don't compromise their values and not realize it. They know. And the truth is, no, we don't always know when we're crossing a line. There are a lot of psychological factors that go into that. Most of us think we are the good guys. How about, right? Don't you assume? Like, we're the good guys, right? They've actually done studies that show that well over half, 70 or 80% of the people surveyed in these studies and by different people over time, think that they have higher ethics than everyone else, are fairer, are less motivated by money, and trying harder to do good than the average person, including the people who aren't, right? So we tend to have a lot of confidence in our ethics and our ability to see values choices and respond appropriately. The fact is, in fact, I'm going to hide this one for a second. I've got to tell you a more disturbing one first. The disturbing thing is, it's not necessarily all having a moral compass. It's not necessarily personal character. We are very susceptible to situational forces as creatures, and we don't like to know. This is really disturbing, so be prepared for a moment, but there's a positive side to it. The most compelling example of this is the Milgram experiments that were done in the 60s. Are most of you familiar with those? Anyone? I'll briefly outline them. There's some things about them that most people don't know. The first thing is that these experiments were designed to prove that Americans were not as compliant as Germans, so we wouldn't have fallen into Hitler's tricks. And they didn't show that. He did studies with thousands of people of different education levels, demographics, occupations. And he put people in situations where they were supposed to be helping a scientist, studying the process of learning, helping someone else learn something, using electric shocks as behavioral feedback. It's kind of gruesome. And since then, there have been a lot of improvements in the ethics of doing experiments because it was so disturbing to the people that were involved. What you had to do was, if the person got the wrong answer, you had to give them a little shock. And the scientist would tell you when to do this. Now, you were really the subject of the experiment. You thought you were being paid to be an assistant, and this person was. They were a Confederate, and they were trained to scream and yell and make all kinds of sounds of discomfort while you were doing your shocks, and the shocks weren't real. The dial went all the way from zero up to danger, brain damage, and death. 63% of the people went all the way to death when told to by a scientist in a white coat. And the instructions for this were, if someone refuses three times, you can stop. The scientist was, but their response was, the experiment requires you to continue. And people were crying, they were going through great anxiety, but they kept doing it because the authority figure told them. The twist is that Milgram then went on and did 19 variations on when do people comply more and when do they comply less. I think this is the fascinating part. When you didn't have to touch the dial, there was a second assistant who actually turned it, compliance went from 63% to 90%. Picture what that means when we work in offices that are 2,000 miles from the place that we're affecting, right? You don't have to feel it. And then the good news, so now I'll relieve things a little bit, was that when someone witnessed two people arguing over whether it was ethical to do this, compliance went from 63% to less than 10%. Just two people. So if you think about whether you're going to speak up in a situation, you might be the person that tips someone else, right? So since then, there have been more ethical approaches to replicating this, where they stop the person before they actually do the harmful thing, but the patterns Milgram identified hold. And then there were some more recent studies in the field of behavioral economics by a fellow named Dan Ariely at MIT, who wrote a book called Predictably Irrational. And it's really blowing the entire myth of rational economic behavior. This is very disturbing. If you remember Greenspan's testimony that his ideology may have been partially incorrect, this is some of what he was referring to, is human beings don't necessarily act rationally. So what Dan Ariely did was, he had a whole bunch of MBA students, and I'm really sorry about this, but there's how we are, gave them a self-scored math test where you got money for the number of correct answers. And they did a control group and found out the distribution of correct answers. Then they did a version where you could shred your answer sheet. Nobody would know if you had cheated, right in front of you. And then people reported how many they got correct. The whole distribution moved up by 2 out of 20. Over 50% of the people, roughly 60% of the people, cheated for that to happen, right? Unless they were just randomly smarter, but he replicated this in multiple places, right? But they only cheated by a little bit. They padded. I mean, they couldn't have been caught. They could have cheated the whole range, but they didn't. They just padded. Then when he said, here, I'm going to pay you in poker chips, right? So you turn in your test and I give you poker chips. You walk across the room to get your cash. It's literally 60 seconds later, but the cheating went up, the distribution moved up by 4 out of 20. Because it wasn't real, right? It's not, I'm not really cheating, it's just poker chips. Even though it turns into money right after. Then the most interesting one was on the waiting room on the way in. On the way in, they said, just write down here how many of the Ten Commandments you remember. Not are you religious? Not do you subscribe to the Ten Commandments? Nothing, just how many you remember. And when they went in, every place they did this, at least 4 schools, multiple times, cheating dropped to 0. I find that's kind of exciting. I mean, it's sad. But this completely flies in the face that we either have a moral compass or we don't. And the more fun versions of this, with Malcolm Gladwell, tells of a story where you can increase your score on Trivial Pursuit by spending 5 minutes before you play thinking of yourself as a college professor, compared to if you think of yourself as a soccer hooligan. They've done studies where if you put mirrors in the room, people are less likely to cheat. And if you have people thinking about luxury products before they go into a decision, they're more likely to be self-interested. So we are incredibly susceptible to the situations around us, right? So we can't count on ourselves to be ethical. This is what tips us into unhealthy compromise without knowing it. But then there's a twist. What comes from that is once we've made an action, we are hardwired to self-justify it. I am honest. I just cheated. This creates cognitive dissonance. We can't handle it, right? We actually get endorphins from rationalizing. It actually feels, they've done fMRIs on people, and you get little hits if you can figure out a way to make those two make sense, right? So once we've taken, and it's more if you take visible action on something, then you feel like you have an emotional investment in that. You need to be right, so what we do is distort our perceptions. We either change our values, I don't really care about cheating, it's not so bad, right? Or I didn't really cheat, or it was just an experiment in real life, I wouldn't cheat, right? All these different things that have us self-justify, that gradually lower our bar. This is the slippery slope. When we talk about the slippery slope of ethics, it's situational forces tip us into something we wouldn't otherwise do, if they're negative forces, and once we've done it, we self-justify it. They did a study of a bunch of 6th grade kids where the only way to... They surveyed them on their attitudes about cheating, and then the only way to get prizes from taking a test was to cheat. It was easy to cheat, and there was no way to be caught, but they could see who had cheated, and those who had cheated had more lenient attitudes about cheating after they had done this. Right? So you can see, back to my diagram of the unhealthy compromise, that it's the situational forces push us into the compromise, and it's the justifying that has us say, now I really got to play the game. The problem is then we become part of the situational forces for the people around us. And that's why I call this the downward spiral. This is what we get disturbed about, right? This spiral. You have whole countries. One fellow I spoke with in November left Cuba because he just couldn't deal with the corruption as it increased, right? Because I know one fellow called in on a webinar and said, my boss just told me, if you're not cheating, you're not trying hard enough. Right? So we're coaching each other based on having self-justified our own compromises, right? So influence each other. If you take advantage of someone, next time they're going to think, this is how it works. Right? There was a study by the Josephson Institute of adults of all ages from high school to 50s, saying the single biggest predictor of lying and cheating was the belief that that's what was needed for success. So we become part of the environment that lets other people think that they have to succeed. Well, so why do we do this and how do we get out of it? The key is when you're in it, it feels like you're in a trap. It feels like you have no choice. It feels like this is what I need to do to pay my mortgage. I know this is a really scary visual, huh? It's basically a Native American salmon trap that I got permission from the artist to use his recreation of it. But the idea is, this is the only way I can do this. I'm stuck. I have got to feed my family. This is life or death. This is the only deal. And the only thing that might have us question that is that the people who do the kinds of compromises that we've seen in the news, when you listen to their stories, I've been reading, I'm getting really distorted, going into the dark side of work, that people really feel that they have no choice. So you remember the Singapore trader who took down Barings Bank? $1.4 billion in losses. You know how it started? One of his employees made a 20,000-pound mistake. And he said, I have to cover this up because I'd be damned if they're going to make me a clerk again. And he tried to trade his way out of a 20,000-pound mistake, and it ended up being $1.4 billion. Anthony Mazzillo of Countrywide, he started out thinking that subprime loans are unethical. He was against it. They were crooks. But he had to be number one. Countrywide had to be the number one lender. He said, if I'm not in subprime, I can't be number one. I guess I got to do it. Right? And lastly, Tony Haywood of BP. Safety is number one. Sir John Brown had to leave because of the Texas City refinery explosion, which is the last BP disaster. Now Tony Haywood comes in and says, safety has to be number one. They invested $1 billion a year in safety efforts, but we also have to meet all our short-term revenue targets. We have no choice. We have to do that. So many cases, people feel that they have no choice. Right? I'm going to ask you guys if you have the props. So the question here is, when you're trapped, when you feel like you're trapped, how do you get out? So I have a little prop as a reminder here that my friends will hand out. Maybe someone else can help you hand out on the other side as we wrap up here. So I'll put this out to you very briefly, and then we'll wrap up. When you feel like you're trapped, how do you get out? What does it take to get out of a trap? Think of the kinds of traps you know of. Not a mouse trap. We wouldn't get stuck by that. But what does it take to get out of a trap? How do traps work? Say it again, Linda.
Tension.
You're going to see some. Huh?
Determination.
Get yourself down out of there. Especially with the bear trap, right? So do you see? Ingenuity. Getting creative. Yes, if you're strong.
Inflict harm on yourself.
In what way?
I don't know. Cut your leg off if you're in a bear trap.
If you're gonna chop, I mean, this is really gruesome. So. Pete?
Stop going for the bait.
Stop going for the bait. Isn't that interesting?
Suggest alternatives, so then the boss has to make the decision as to, you know, which of the two ways to go.
So don't buy into that you have to do it, right? You're surfacing the trade-offs. And that's you're translating it from a physical trap into the business environment or a work environment. But I think what you're describing over here is the bait is what keeps us hooked or gets us into it, and then the willingness to sacrifice, and in this case maybe you don't look like you're quite as on top of it if you have to surface the choice back to your boss, is willing to make sacrifices to stay alive or to keep your freedom. Because the way traps tend to work is they trick us into focusing too narrowly, right? And the best example I know of this, the salmon trap I'll show you in just a moment, there's a twist on this one. But another one is the monkey hand trap. Have you guys ever heard of this one? In Southeast Asia, they put food inside a gourd with a hole, and the monkey goes in and grabs it, and it's attached by a chain, so he can't go away. But he can't get his hand out of the hole with the food in it, right? So he stays there. Can't eat it. I want food, right? So that's the bait. Until the trapper comes along and grabs him, right? Food he can't eat, or she can't eat. And the key would be to let go of this, knowing you have something larger at stake, like getting caught, right? In this case, the salmon trap, the salmon is stuck by their assumption that they have to go forward, that you have to deliver, you know, the results you promised to your boss. There's a hole at the back of that trap. All they have to do is back up, and you can jump over it. What about the ones that you all have in your hands? How do you get stuck? Are you familiar with the finger trap? So my sample is up here somewhere. So usually a compromise trap involves we want to get away from something, right? I don't want to be put back as a clerk because my employee made an error. I got to push harder or avoid this bad thing, right? How do you get out? The counterintuitive, right? So it involves two things. I'm stuck. It involves two things. And this is what I call the compromise trap, is you're stuck as long as you assume, all those misconceptions that you have to thrive by getting to the top, all those things. And you free yourself by broadening your perspective to see, do I really want that bait? And is it worth it if it's going to cost me these other things? Right? Well, how do we remember that when we're in the midst of survival mode? Because you know how it gets when you're pushed to play the game, right? You know what people describe, you're in survival mode, it's kill or be killed, life or death consequences for little things at work. Did I get as big a promotion or a raise as the next person? You get in this frenzy and you get narrow view, right? How do we remember that there's something bigger at stake, that the price could be too high, we have other options, something else might be what we really want? How do we remember? Time out, time. Reflection, Kevin mentioned the Buddhist. A lot of it is other people. A lot of it is someone else saying, is this really what you're up to? Even the Ten Commandments is being connected to society and saying, huh, there's bigger stuff here. People described to me feeling like they had no choice because something was right in front of their face, that the difficult choices were right there, and they didn't see the bigger picture. They didn't see how they influenced each other. And I'll give you an example of something that could have been the BP disaster and wasn't. A manufacturing manager in a heavy industry field, a chemical plant, had a new manager come in, and one day he said, you know, there's some safety procedures that we're not following, and you need to know about these. That night, he looked, and the procedures had been deleted. That's one way to stop being out of compliance. Just eliminate the information. But he had a printout. He knew it was there. So he called the manager, and he said, did you do this? And the manager said, no, no, no. What are you talking about? I would never do that. And he called his wife, and he said, oh, I'm going to get this guy. I'm mad. And she said, wait a few hours. 9:30 that night, he got a phone call. The guy was on the phone. This is a big, we're talking Texas, tough guy, manufacturing plant. He's crying on the phone. He said, I was just trying to read a bedtime story to my daughter, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it knowing I had lied to you and I had deleted that procedure. I don't know what we do now, but this is not the kind of person I want to be. And between them, they came clean, put the procedures back in, and really started addressing how are we going to live up to these. And that team has actually got a new commitment now to knowing how easy it is to get off kilter. This can happen for the positive as well, to the conscious business stuff. I know one group was doing a green product, but they never quite tackled the difficult part. Right? And you'll notice these are followers. These are not bosses. One team member said, hey, those are really great specs we had for making this green. How about we do that for real? Right? Didn't antagonize it. Just, come on, this was good. Let's do it. So this can make it an upward spiral. This can be, it's literally catching. There are other studies that show when we watch someone do a good deed, it actually makes us want to. So this is the upward spiral, and it's about how we interact with each other wherever we're situated, with whatever power we have as followers, peers, bosses, whatever. So my question to you now as we open it up, and I'd love to hear your questions and comments and stories as we do this, is how would we go about addressing the breakdown in integrity that we've had recently, and truthfully it's been going on for some time, if we really face the fact that we can all go both ways? We can all be tipped into playing the game, and we can all be moved over to redefining the game, and it's other people, probably, as well as practices, that help us move. How would we regulate differently if that were the case? How would we educate leaders? How would we lead, knowing somebody else might have the information we need to hear that would create some cognitive dissonance but might save us some pretty big consequences, right? How would we follow differently, knowing that if a leader compromised, maybe they weren't aware of it? So I'd be interested to hear any of your comments on that, as well as any other questions that you have.
Thank you. We'll be turning it over for questions in just a minute. Right now, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum. We are sponsoring the program tonight. Our program this evening is The New Leadership Mindset, 10 Misconceptions About Compromise at Work with Elizabeth Doty. Now we're going to open it up for audience questions here. Okay, well, I'll ask a question then. Now, you actually, I was lucky enough to read your book before tonight. You actually interviewed 400 people. And what made you, is there a 12-step program for interviewers?
As I say, chronic interviewing, yeah. So I did 52 2-to-3-hour interviews specifically for the book, 67 informal conversations with people, and if any of you know me, I do have an addiction to index cards. I have like 12 boxes of index cards at home where I took notes on these informal conversations, basically about how do you sort out what you'll do and not do. And then from my prior career in the consulting business, it really was how I stayed sane. It's like just trying to talk to people, how do you make meaning of this? Because I think it's a trick to stay alive in organizations. And that goes to my 10th misconception. It's not a bad organization that has compromises. It's the entropy. It's the chaos of organizations. It's tricky to stay alive in there, to stay human. It needs all of us, right? So that was how I did it, was by just, I would say, how did you get here? And I tell you, it's kind of, Studs Terkel is one of my inspirations, who was a storyteller about work. And I think there's something about, it was very satisfying to people to tell me their stories. I remember, several long train rides. I'm kind of addicted to trains also. Sitting with people all night talking about designing the Mazda transmission, you know, whatever it was. So, next question.
So, Elizabeth, if you can remember back to the beginning, when you first were about to write this book or got the impetus, I'd like to know two things. What was it that you were hoping to discover, and what most surprised you in your journey of writing?
It's a funny one. So what sparked me to write the book was going to a movie with my two friends who are actually here this evening. Claudia, Pat's right behind you. And just being reminded that there are things that go on in the world and society that we can ignore if we want to, and that we don't have to pay attention to what's most calling for our attention. And so we asked ourselves at lunch what was calling for our attention that we could ignore if we wanted to but might make us act differently. And for me, it was climate change. I said, you know, if that's really going on, I might need to change how I live my life. So I started to get curious as to if business is a big part of regulatory change for getting on to climate, along with other things, what's stopping people in business from acting on that or any other concerns they might have as citizens? So I thought I'd be talking to people about how they weigh issues with family values. I didn't care, in a political spectrum, I didn't care. But it's how do you weigh these big societal things with your workplace priorities? I had worked with people at Hewlett-Packard who said, my job is to get people to print and use paper. And I'm an environmentalist. What am I doing? Right? So that's what I thought I would find, right? I was really curious. I thought that might open up some options for making quicker, more direct action on some societal issues that seemed important to me. What shocked me was people going, Elizabeth, that's a luxury. I can't even keep my word. I make a promise to an employee that if they sacrifice for 9 months, then they're going to get a promotion. Realistically, I can't keep my word. I can't keep my quality standards. I mean, it's not all horrible, but it's enough of an issue that people are weighing it. So I was really surprised to find out how much that pressure to drink the Kool-Aid and be absorbed, you know, kind of become the person you need to be in the organization, crowded out even, you know, attention, let alone the courage or strength or strategies for bringing in larger issues. But I think this is a place to start, because if we can start keeping our word and living up to our quality standards, we might start thinking about, like the fellow who said, oh, my company's lobbying against carbon emission caps even while we're socially responsible. Oh, so it might come in. But I think this is the place to start. Thank you.
I have two things. The first one is about something that you already said, that you'll always know if you're crossing a line. No, we don't.
Yeah.
And my experience of that is oftentimes afterwards, sometimes a long time afterwards, I can look back and say, oh, yeah, I did cross that line. I'm curious whether you heard that in some of your research.
Yeah. It was interesting. So one of the twists in this whole thing was that perception is a huge part of living up to our values. It's not just whether we choose right and wrong and sorting out ethical dilemmas, but how much we'll let ourselves be aware of. And what people described was having a gut sense, a visceral sense, a sense of doubt, something. It was a lot of it was gut sense, like something stuck in my craw, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And later on they went, oh, that's why that was. That's why that was. The other thing was that question about organizational integrity. Things didn't often happen with one decision. It was an accumulation of decisions that led people to say, oh, this is no longer right for me. For example, a fellow went to work for a carpet company and discovered that they made recyclable carpet squares, and he was really excited about it. And then they said, oh, but you also have to sell the old toxic stuff that goes to landfill, and that's part of your quota, and you have a mix that you have to sell. But we're going to come out pretty soon with a way of recovering that, and it won't go to landfill. So he went along, and then later on said, a year and a half, there's no news about recovering this broadloom carpeting. So the decision itself literally became wrong. Like, he could no longer go out and sell. So both. One was the personal awareness evolved over time, and the other was the situation was an accumulation of decisions that led to him to feel this wasn't a right thing for him. I had that in my own work. Kevin mentioned I started out in re-engineering. Do you all remember that fad movement, Dark Force? we did some inspiring stuff. I was part of one of the top 10 re-engineering firms in the country, and we did some really incredible things involving people in redesigning their own work. But I was trained to do the analysis of how much benefit we would get, and I would go in and say, $35 million, 50% cut in recycle time, you know, in cycle time, 20% increase in quality in 3 months, right? And initially, I believed those. They fit all my spreadsheets. But then I was on 3 or 4 projects, and it doesn't work that way. And so the fourth time I went into a client to say that, it was after I said the words. It was very interesting, and the flag didn't go off. It was after I said the words, oh, I just lied. Knowing what I know, I can't say that in good conscience. And so the fellow with the broadloom carpeting, he gave me a really interesting principle. He said, it's not as soon as you know that you're responsible. It's as soon as you should have known. As soon as there's enough information to tell you, you know, discussing the what changes in the circumstances variation on your question, it's as soon as the data's there that you could know if you were open to it. And so one of the most important things to me is, do you really want to know? Right? And I think internally it's the same thing. Is, did that sit well with me? We find out later, oh, that's really nagging at me. That's not who I am. And we learn about ourselves. And the integrity is not a fixed thing. Thank you. Did you have another question too?
Yeah, I had a situation today at work, actually, where I had been creating this report that was way more than was required in the past, and it took a lot longer than the deadline.
Yeah.
So my boss said, okay, give me a project plan to, you know, for doing it faster. And so my response to him was, well, if we do it the way we did in the past, we can't, you know, it's not feasible, mm-hmm. but if we do a bare bones version first, we can make the date, and then we can embellish it later on.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't heard back yet what the decision will be, but
that
was the only way that I could deal with it. But I think he wanted me to say, well, oh, we'll make the deadline, and we'll do it just like we did in the past.
Right. There is often that pressure, and in a lot of ways, I think it comes from bosses being overwhelmed. I just can't deal with it. Just make it so. Right? But I think over time, the people I've spoken with and the stories as they came into that natural sense of authority of, look, this is real, a real trade-off, I might as well surface it to you, that it actually does lead to greater promotions, greater respect in most cases if you do that. There is the caveat of helping them manage being overwhelmed by having all the decisions go back to them. The other question I would have for you is, do you feel good about a bare-bones version? Is there any downside in terms of how it could be misused, people treating it as if it were solid gold when it wasn't? Because I've had cases of that. So, thank you. Next.
Hi. I love this conversation, so thank you. Mm. I'm curious how you get people, when they know if they have fear, to actually act courageously. I actually work for an organization called the Heroic Imagination Project, founded by Phil Zimbardo, who, with Milgram, did the Stanford Prison Experiment. So it's all about teaching kids in schools, and we're about to go into Google in May, about how vulnerable we all are, basically to what you're saying, and then using a social fitness model that came out of a clinic at Stanford, mm-hmm. which I think of as sort of the social flight simulation. Okay. So they get to desensitize to how scary it is to speak up.
Yeah.
But we're always looking for ways that people are inspiring people to do the courageous thing when it's really scary.
Yeah, and I appreciate, so much of what I've spoken about in terms of situational influences is influenced by, it comes from the Lucifer effect, so Zimbardo's book. And I also appreciate his idea of a new kind of hero, right? It's a more subtle and humble kind of hero, and a lot of this is about humility. What I identified when I went through all the stories people told me and then the informal conversations with this, there's six things that help people over time and sometimes in the moment activate that larger perspective of being able to redefine the game. And it's literally a different perspective on the risks of stepping up because you're in an expanded mind frame or mindset rather than the small one where you're vulnerable and they have all the cards. And so the six that I came up with, and that's like the second half of the book, is one is staying in touch with your own personal strengths. Actively doing things that remind you of what you're good at and why you're here and how you have value to contribute that can't be taken away from you. Right? So you're part of contributing. And you can do that in a moment with some neurolinguistic programming kind of activities to activate those strengths, or you can just stay in touch with it over time and know that you need to. And this involves some of the personal habits of really taking, of self-care and really taking the breaks. Doing, one woman I know said, I go on retreat exactly when I say I don't need it and I can't afford it. That's when I need it. So that was the first one. The second one is seeing, I use the metaphor of a game just to kind of make it memorable. So this is staying in touch with your strengths. The next would be seeing the larger playing field. When we expand our perspective to who's going to be impacted, because strangely enough, when we have an ethics issue, we think, oh, my little ethics, it's kind of prissy. But when you think about who's going to be affected, you're sensing some harm that's going to be done. If you stay in touch with that, you have all the backup of those that are going to be harmed. Like there's a fellow who contributed to an SNL collapse in Ohio because he didn't want to admit that he'd made a mistake on an audit. He was an accountant. So he gave them a little more time by knowingly signing off on fraudulent financial statements because he didn't want to admit to his bosses. He said, if I had thought about the depositors who were going to lose their life savings, I mean, no question. Right? Can you feel the difference? It kind of activates your sense. What am I talking about here? I can't do that. So activating that sense of the larger field and the consequences. People literally describe like going to Brazil to look at the markets where they're trying to sell consumer products. They were like getting sneaky about small packages and stuff. And they looked around. They looked around at this incredible poverty, and they said, people don't need soft drinks. Right? That's what he was telling. He literally couldn't breathe. He was like, how could I do this to these people? But it had to be vivid. So I think field trips, I know one guy who takes BART in the city just so he can see who might need his help, because otherwise in his car he's going to be too insulated. And then the third one is a sense of a worthy enough win, something you're shooting for that really calls for courage. That you're up to a bigger yardstick and you don't have time for the petty politics and worrying if you got the promotion and all that stuff because you're here to do something. And strangely enough, being more ambitious unlocks that sense of courage, unlocks your strength. The fourth one is having a real team. And a lot of times this is a very strange twist and it goes into some more difficult psychological areas. Many people felt pressed to play the game because of their home relationships. And they avoided, and a lot of people told me that the compromise trap that they fell into was with their marriages. And so they felt pushed to do things that they didn't feel good about because they didn't come home and clean up and make this a real alliance. And so having those kinds of stronger relationships in your life, allies, strong relationship with your kids and your partner, where they know the real cost to you of playing along and you're up to similar goals, that strengthens you. The fifth is building the skills for doing it, like I said with the positive no. And the sixth is keeping your own darn score. Don't let somebody else keep your scorecard. And the best example I know of this, I love it, he actually wrote back to me when I asked him about it. George Foreman, the boxer, has a score that I love. He was quoted in the Wall Street Journal as saying his investment goal is to pay $1 billion in taxes. It flips everything on its head, right? It's very generous, but if he's paying $1 billion in taxes, he's probably doing okay on his living. right? So I wrote to him and I asked him how he was doing. And he said he was, you know, about a third of the way there. So this kind of thing where you're referencing off what you really care about instead of what you're told is important and falling into following the herd. So those were the six.
Right here. A quick comment. I remember Bill Drayton of Ashoka speaking recently at the Commonwealth, and he spoke of two most important skills that we should teach kids today, and one of them was empathy. Mm. And I thought, what a connection, right? Mm. Because empathy is your conduit to integrity, in a sense. If you don't sense what's happening, if you can't empathize, it's really hard to stay in your integrity. The question that I have is, you know, one of the beliefs, I think it was the last one, you mentioned that individual integrity does not necessarily add up to systemic integrity.
Yes.
And I find that to be very true, being part of a larger organization.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, and I have my theories about it and answers, but I wonder if you can comment and maybe give some examples, just share how you see it.
Great. So to the first one on empathy, an awful lot of people I meet in the business world say that we have integrity if we have a high say-do ratio. You guys heard this phrase? What I say I'm going to do, I'm going to do. But the truth is, that's not what integrity feels like. Integrity feels like being up to something worthwhile that is connected to the world around me, that it reflects my responsibilities and needs and a sensing. So I think the empathy is a really important part there, and we just naturally respond when we're in touch with it. Right? So that makes perfect sense to me. And then the individual and the organizational integrity, this woman who wrote the book Value Shift, which is a very long book, has one little paragraph that I consider the most important thing, though the book is interesting. She said there are seven functions that have to be in place for a company or organization to keep its promises, and only one of those is for individuals to keep their promises. And I give you an example. When I make a promise, like a salesperson, salespeople are always making promises, right? On behalf of companies, and some unmeetable promises, right? I have to be able to gauge what the organization's capable of. I have to be able to say, or if I make a promise to an employee for a promotion, I have to know whether it's going to actually be doable. That's over and above my integrity about promises, right? It's a plus. And it doesn't fall in, usually it doesn't fall into an integrity question. It usually falls in, we consider it an effectiveness question. But at an organizational level, it is an integrity question. Because if I make a promise we can't meet, I've broken a promise. It goes on from there. I have a way to transfer promises once I've made them. I have to be able to track which promises are there, a way to recover if they're broken, a way to correct if something can't be met, to have educational systems to have everyone understand how we make promises. So there's seven functions that have to be in place for an organization just to keep its promises. And then someone I admire, I don't know if he was able to come tonight, Marvin Brown is a local professor, wrote a book called Corporate Integrity, and he said that's just the beginnings of integrity as an organization. Because we have responsibilities to the larger society, responsibilities to have a worthy purpose, responsibilities to stay in touch with reality, because if our products are causing harm, even if we keep our promises on delivering them, we're not meeting them. So those would be examples of what it takes to get to an organizational level. And the simplest way to look at that is Dr. Deming's old examples with every department cuts its quality a little bit. It might make sense in the near, but you add up, you're breaking promises to customers. Is that it? Okay. I have one more question.
Hi, Elizabeth.
So hold on one second. I just wanted to say that we've reached a point in our program where we only have time for one last question. That'll be your question. But I do want to remind our listening audience at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley, Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum, and your host for tonight. Our program this evening has been The New Leadership Mindset, 10 Misconceptions About Compromise at Work with Elizabeth Doty. And now we'll turn over for the final question of the evening.
Hi, Elizabeth. I guess that most of the people you've interviewed have been in business. I'm wondering if you've interviewed politicians, government workers, and especially lately with what's going on in Washington and the budget and the discussion of compromise, which for me feels very much like an unhealthy compromise. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and whether that may be your next book.
There's someone here I could ask. But the interesting thing to me that came through in a lot of the conversations, first of all, was people said this applied to their personal lives, was a major theme. Another one was people in nonprofits, philanthropists, activists. I talked to someone from the EPA. Said, oh, no, we have this all the time. Now, business gets labeled as because of greed we compromise, but I found this in many other areas, and I would love to do this also internationally, right? How is it different in other places? But I'll give you an example of someone who is passionate about a philanthropical organization. He said, I feel like I'm selling my soul because I'm spending all my time raising money and I'm not actually making sure we meet our mission. Activists who feel like they have to kind of turn the tables on a corporation that was cooperating with them because they need to look like they're against the corporation. How destructive is that of companies that might like to try to do something different? And then now in Washington, I know on the budget issue, there, we get into this thing where we think that you're only being true to yourself. This goes to my lower, what does it mean to stand up for yourself? We can get into this thought that we're only being true to ourselves if we're fighting the other side, that if they lose. And there were some incredible studies that showed Israeli and Palestinian negotiators turned down their own proposals when they were labeled as coming from the other side. Because if they want it, it must be bad for me. And we said, oh, those Middle Eastern folks. So they did it again with Democrats and Republicans and had the same result. So I think we're now in a very interesting place. It goes to a cultural mindset of Americans. We love to be on the frontier, the hero, the pioneer. We have a wonderful asset in our focus on individual drive and initiative and responsibility. But what we lose is a sense that we have shared interests and connections, and that if we ignore those, we may be actually undermining our own well-being as well as others. And in this case, I think we're heading towards the debt ceiling question as well as the budget, playing chicken with things that we have a shared outcome. And I think most of the American people I know are tired of that posturing. There are an awful lot of people that say, be pragmatic about a shared interest here. There, a friend of mine has a number of postcards around what your priorities are for the budget. If you're interested, I'll be able to share some of those with you so you can say what our priorities would be. So, does that answer your question? Thank you.
Well, thank you. So I would like to thank our speaker, Elizabeth Doty, for being here tonight with us at the Commonwealth Club. I also want to thank our audience here at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.